start tonight by just saying how encouraging it was last week to see the number of our own members who were here each night. We've been here for right at 8.5 years, just a little over 8.5 years. And while I don't have the numbers written down, I'm fairly confident to say that this past meeting was better attended number-wise from our own members than any of the other meetings we've had before. And that was very encouraging. It's good to see brethren who are willing to set aside the time and to come out each and every night and to support the preaching. And I know we all were blessed by being here and encouraged by the lessons that Brother Bill brought. But I just wanted to let you, I know Bill said something about it as he was closing on Friday, but I wanted to let you know that I noticed that as well. And it was very encouraging. On Friday night, I believe it was, when I so rudely interrupted everything and Bill wanted to know if I needed something in the back, I needed to step out to cough, and when I came back in, I just noticed the good number. We didn't have a whole lot of visitors that night, and so I was back there counting. I wanted to see just how many were here, and Bill thought I needed something, so he paused. But that was very encouraging. I hope we continue that in the future. I mentioned sometime back in October, that we had gone through a study while I was up in Russellville, the book of Ecclesiastes, and I mentioned that I wanted to look at the book and go through some things with you all. And so I want to begin that tonight. It's not going to be a prolonged study, maybe a few weeks, but I think that it will help you. I know it helped me, and I'm hoping that the things we'll look at will help you as well. When I first started reading my Bible, there were a couple of books that were quite surprising to me. The book of Job. When I came to the book of Job and read through Job, I was really shocked. I had always heard of the patience of Job, the perseverance of Job. And then I started reading through the book, and I thought, well, there in the first two chapters, yes, Job has it nailed down. He is patient, he is persevering. But then as you get on into the book, I start wondering, well, this isn't the Job that I've always heard about. Now, that's no slight on Job. I think that was my fault in the way looking and not understanding and a lot of other things going into it. Job was a very patient man. Job was a persevering man. I don't want to take anything away from Job tonight, other than just to say, when you read through the book for the first time, it may surprise you what you find in some of the things that Job said. But you come to chapter 42, and make no mistake about it, Job is a faithful man who trusts in his God. Well, you read on a little bit further, and you come to the book of Ecclesiastes. And Ecclesiastes, if you know anything about the book, maybe you know something about chapter 12. Maybe you've heard someone talk about the conclusion of the whole matter. And so if you've just heard Ecclesiastes 12, verses 13 and 14, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. So you hear that, fear God and keep His commandments, and you think, okay, here's a book that's going to help us to do just that. Fear God and keep His commandments. You go back and start reading. Well, the first time reading through it, it seems like maybe the most pessimistic of all the books of the Bible. The book of Lamentations is, I think, by far maybe the saddest book of the Bible. The book of Jeremiah, it doesn't have a lot of bright spots in it, but it's just as far as pessimism, you know, not having a bright outlook, the book of Ecclesiastes has to be right up there at the top. But is that what God intended for us in the book? I think when we finish up, that what we're going to find is that this book will encourage us, maybe will be one of the most encouraging books to help us to learn to fear God and to keep His commandments. But it's going to take some work on our part to look at the book as a whole to understand it and to then make some applications, which, quite frankly, I think may be more difficult than we understand or imagine. And I say that because we, including myself, oftentimes find ourselves saying things and doing things that really are not in keeping with what we find that our attitude should be according to this book. Well, if we start right here in chapter 1, you might understand why I said that as you read through it for the first time, you might look at this as a very pessimistic type of book. Because right here in verses 1 through 3, we don't have what seems to be a very encouraging start to a book that's supposed to help us in our walk with God. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? The word vanity, defined by Webster's, means something vain, empty, or valueless. It's worthless. It's not worth a thing. That's what vanity is. There's no good in it. And that's what the author begins here by telling us. And he doesn't just say there are some vain things in the world. He says all is vanity. He said, well, maybe not everything. Maybe he's not including everything. There's some things. Surely there's some things we could do. That'd be some good. But then you come to verse 3. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? Well, that doesn't give me much hope. That doesn't encourage me and spur me on. That doesn't get me excited about doing a whole lot, because if that's true, and let me tell you, it is, then why bother? If all is vanity, if there's nothing good that can come from my labor under the sun, then why do anything? Well, we're going to answer that question as we go through, but I'm not going to give you the answer just yet. Look at some examples with me that are given to prove this statement that all is vanity. He's not just going to say it in verse 2 and leave it. He's going to come back and he'll say it again and again. And he's going to give some different examples to show that all is vanity. He starts out there. We read verse 3, but verse 3 just begins this next section. All the way down through verse 11, where he's showing that there's no value, there's no good in anything that we could do under the sun. So we'll begin in verse 3. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it goes. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. There's no remembrance of the former things, nor will there be any remembrance of the things that are to come by those who will come after. Now, you read those verses, and as we're going to find with a lot of the passages in the book of Ecclesiastes, I think there's maybe a traditional way that we've looked at it. I don't want to put that off on all of you, but I know for me, there's a way that I've looked at this before. You look at what it says there in verses 5 through 8. You've got this world and all that's in it, and everything's just running. But you could read those verses and come away with the idea of, look, God created this world, and look how magnificent it is. Everything just works like clockwork. It just comes and goes, and everything just right on time. But I don't think that is what the author here is trying to show us. I don't think he's trying to show us the majesty and the splendor of God by the way that the world just keeps on churning and going and going. I think the point that he makes is seen there in verse 7, all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. The place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. All this work, all the energy that's put into the things that happen in this world, well, it just starts all over again. It's just an endless cycle. There's another verse there in verse 9, the last part of verse 9. There's nothing new under the sun. That is a true expression, and that's one that we could use when we're talking about sin today, when we're talking about problems of today. Sometimes it's encouraging to know that, well, there's nothing new. That's the same thing that's been faced before. But I don't think that's the reason he writes here that there's nothing new under the sun. In the context of the verses we just read, what he's saying is, look at all the labor. Look at all that's put into work and trying to accomplish something in this world. And you put it all in, and what are you going to get? The same old thing that we've always had. You're not going to get anything new. You're not going to come up with anything new. It's all just the same old thing. And if you start there in verse 2 and read down through verse 11, you'll see that I think that is the idea that's being expressed here. It's not such a wonderful thing that, well, there's nothing new. It's kind of a dreadful thing of, look, you're going to spend maybe 80, 90 years in this life, and what good are you going to do? You're not going to accomplish anything that somebody before you hadn't already accomplished. And you just give it a little time, and you're going to be forgotten, and the things that you've done will be forgotten, and it's just an endless cycle that just keeps going and keeps going. And that's a theme that's really going to run throughout the book. And you think about that, and you think, well, why are we here? What's the use? Why bother? Now, young people, don't take this and say, oh, I kind of like that. I'm just not going to do anything. I'm going to be lazy. No, there's more to it, but that is the view being expressed here by the author. Let's look at a few other examples. In verse 12 beginning, pick up right there. I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed, all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be numbered. Now, we might think that in our position with our limited resources, there's not a whole lot I can do. There's not a whole lot I can accomplish in this life. But if you had somebody who had all the riches of this world, and you had somebody that had all of the wisdom of this world, and you put those two things together, surely that person could really do something. Well, that's who's writing here. When he says in verse 13, I've set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom. This is Solomon. He's got all the wisdom he needs. And for all that he has and all that he knows, what he comes away with is all is vanity and grasping for the wind. If it's crooked, you're not going to straighten it out. If it's lacking, well, you're not going to be able to add to it. Again, not a very encouraging type of revelation there. Come to chapter 2. Let's suppose that for all of your labor and all of your work and all that you put into this life, you're actually able to accomplish something. You're actually able to gain a little bit of something. Maybe it's not great in the eyes of the world, but maybe you've got something. Well, look at chapter 2, beginning verse 18. Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool, yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity. So for what little bit you might be able to attain, acquire, accomplish, one day you're going to die, and then whose is it going to be? You say, well, I left it in my will. I wrote it in my will, and I told him this is who I wanted to go to, and this is what I wanted to do with it, but you know what? When you die, they're going to do what they want to. And you have no more control over it. Maybe they will respect your wishes, but how long will that take? You know, maybe your child will. What about the grandchild and then their child? Eventually, you're going to be forgotten. Your wishes are going to be forgotten. And all that you worked for, well, it's just going to just be gone. So, again, not very encouraging. Well, look at chapter 4. This is something that I think many of us have experienced, and we could testify to the truthfulness of these verses. Chapter 4, beginning in verse 1, "Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there's power, but they have no comforter. Therefore I praise the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who's not seen the evil work that is done under the sun." I mentioned the book of Job earlier. You remember Job lamented the day of his birth. He wished that he had never been born. And that's what the writer here is saying. The person who is best off is the one that's never been born. The one that's dead is better than the one that's alive, because the one that's alive has to face all of the troubles and oppressions of this world. Look over in chapter 9. And we're skipping quite a bit in between there, but we just don't have time to look at everything. But look in chapter 9, beginning in verse 1. "For I considered all this in my heart, so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good, the clean, and to the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath, as he who fears an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead." What he's saying here, well, if you're good and righteous, clean, you're going to die. If you're wicked, unrighteous, unclean, you're going to die. The same event happens to all of us. And so, how are we going to change anything? Look on further in chapter 9, verse 11. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. For man also does not know his time. Like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, so the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. So not only are we all going to die, but we really have no control over when that's going to happen and how it's going to happen. Time and chance happen to us all, and just when it's our time, it's our time. And we go. Do you see why? Maybe he starts out saying, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. Well, if we ended right there, well, that'd just be sad. Wouldn't be very encouraging. And it wouldn't be anything really, I think, that would spur us to, in verse 12, fear God and keep His commandments. In fact, from what we've looked at so far, we might come away with the conclusion of, why bother? But why does it even matter if you fear God and keep His commandments, seeing that it is not going to prosper us anything here in this life? Well, before we get into a real study of the book, we need to understand that we can't do what we just did. We can't go through and just take these verses and then these verses and then another set of verses over here and look at those and say, yeah, I see the truthfulness of that. And so therefore, since there's truth in it, then that must be what we're supposed to get from it. We need to take the book as a book. Too often in our reading and in our studies, we like to come and reach in and take a handful of passages that will help to make our point. And we might also add that that's vanity and grasping for the wind, if that's all we have. But we don't need to treat the Scriptures that way. The book of Proverbs is the only book that we have in the Scriptures really where you might have a verse, two verses, three, that stand alone. And there are, we do see that in the book of Proverbs, but the book of Ecclesiastes is not like that. You can't come to a verse and read it and say, that's truthful. I can see that in this life, and therefore That's going to be my mission statement. There's a reason that these things are written the way that they're written, but we've got to take it all. And as we study this book as a book and see the complete work, I think we'll begin to see the special treasure that God has given to us in this book. Bill talked in last week about taking a peg and putting a peg down somewhere and then building our understanding of any particular topic around that thing that we can be certain of. Well, I would hesitate to come to the book of Ecclesiastes, and I'm telling you, I think you should hesitate to come to the book of Ecclesiastes and put your peg down somewhere. Because a lot of what is spoken in the book of Ecclesiastes, while we might say, well, that's truthful, it's a matter of perspective. And that's what we're going to see, that as we look at the book and try to understand the book, we have to have the right perspective. And so we might not want to start putting our peg down in a lot of different places in the book of Ecclesiastes. Whatever's written here has to harmonize with the rest of Scripture. And when we see this book as it works together with the other 65 books of the Bible, I think we'll see that they all harmonize really well. As we go through this study, I want you to, with any study, we need to do this. We need to put off whatever we thought, you know. We need to have an open mind, not already be settled on, well, this is the truth, and I've already studied this, and I figured it out, and this is the truth on that. When we were going through this study up in Russellville, Wes Brown was teaching the class, and there's a particular verse, and I wanted to bring it up tonight, but I'm going to wait. But there was a particular verse that he brought up, or passage, and as he gave the ordinary, the general understanding of the passage, I was thinking, well, yeah, that's right. That's the way we use that. And then he showed an alternative way that the verse really should be understood. And it took me a little while to let it sink in, but after looking at everything, I thought, that's exactly right. But the funny thing to me is, since that, Al Tucker hadn't been that long ago, but since that time, I have heard that verse quoted by Christians on a number of occasions in the way that I think we'll look at and see that it's not intended to be used. You'll just have to keep wondering what that verse is. We're going to get to it, but what I want you to see right now is have an open mind as we're looking through, and don't be settled on an understanding of any particular verse or passage here until we've put it all together. I want to spend just a little bit of time talking about the author. I don't think any of you all probably have ever come across anybody that disputed the fact that Solomon wrote the book. I don't spend a lot of time reading commentaries. I certainly don't spend a lot of time reading the scholars of the day, the modern scholars. And I don't think you all do either. But if you did, you would find that there are a lot of scholars, and for the recording, I'm putting that in quotes. I don't think they're very scholarly to make the point, but you'll find that there are a lot of scholars who would argue that Solomon is not the author. And they give a few reasons why Solomon wouldn't be the author. Well, I want us to look just briefly and see who else could it have been. Is there any other option? Well, first of all, in verse 1, it says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So though Solomon is not named in the book, can we think of someone who would be the son of David, king in Jerusalem? Now understand that sometimes son of can mean grandson or even great-grandson, a descendant of. Jesus is a son of David, far, far removed from David, but he is a descendant. He could be considered a son of David. But it doesn't just say son of David. It says son of David, king. There were a lot of sons that David had that didn't serve as king, but this one is king, and he's king in Jerusalem. So that limits who this could be, or at least who it's claiming to be. to Solomon, Rehoboam, Abijah, Asa. We go through that chron. It's got to be one of them because it's a son of David who was also king in Jerusalem. So it has to be a king of Israel during the United Kingdom or a descendant of David reigning over Judah in the period of Judah alone. But then look at a few other things that are said in verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. That's the same thing we saw in verse 1. But then look in verse 16. I communed with my heart saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive this also as grasping for the wind. But who could make that statement in verse 16? That I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were in Jerusalem before me. Could Rehoboam say that? No, Solomon was before him. And would we think that Rehoboam was smarter, wiser than Solomon? No. There's not a single one that could come after Solomon that could say that he had attained greater wisdom than all who come before him in Jerusalem. If, as we go on in chapter 2, you'll see some other things that are stated that while Solomon's name is not used, it's the only name that makes sense. If Solomon didn't write the book, then someone claiming to be Solomon wrote the book. And then they signed Solomon's name by using this language that we've just looked at. And that doesn't give me a lot of confidence in the book itself. If the person writing it is not truthful about who he is, then why would I want to look at anything else he wrote? So the author is Solomon. And that's important to note. Not just to be able to know that these scholars are wrong, but it's going to help us in our understanding of the book. Look in chapter 2. And I'm going to read verses 4 through 11. But as I read them, I don't want you to think about Solomon. I want you to think about me. I wouldn't often say this, but I want you to think about me. And I'm going to read, when I say I want you to think about Brad, okay? And let me know, you let me know afterwards, but think about how would you understand it, how would you feel about these things that are said if it's referring to me. All right, begin in verse 4. I made my works great. I built myself houses. I planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold, and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I've acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me, you might say in brat. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I didn't keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands have done and all the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. I know that was difficult for you, but you know, I have added on to the house since we've been there. And we got that shed in the back that I fixed up. And we used to have a grapevine back there in the back that I did some with, and I planted some blueberry bushes and some plum trees. They didn't work out too well. Had some chickens. That might be my flocks and herds. And the water pools, I know you probably hadn't seen, but over on the right side of the yard, there's a little dig out that sometimes when it rains real hard, water will stand there. And you see how ridiculous that would be to try to go to somebody and say, look at all that I've done, and I have just tried everything. And let me tell you, it just all just came to nothing. Well, if it were me, if it were any one of us, if it were really anybody else other than Solomon, maybe somebody like David, we might think, well, yeah, you haven't done anything, but I've seen where you live. You know, it's kind of modest, common. It wouldn't really have any effect on saying, well, I've tried it all, I've done it all, and really there's no good that could come from it. Well, if it's somebody like me, you say, well, yeah, that's right. You ain't tried hard enough. You don't have enough. What you have, that meager existence, is just not compelling to make me think that there's nothing out there for me. But when you have somebody like Solomon, the wisest, the richest, who says, I've tried it all, I've done it all, I've searched it out, and it's not there. Now that's compelling. Now that's somebody that I can look at and say, I don't think I could outdo him. I don't think he could tell me it doesn't work, and I could say, well, I think I'll try it, and I can do better than him. You know, it has an impact. So, more than just to prove the scholars wrong, we need to understand that Solomon wrote this book. And as we go through and look at what Solomon put his hand to do and to try, we can understand we're not going to be able to outdo him in those physical things. So we're not going to be able to come up with a different conclusion that he comes to, that is all just vanity of vanity. All is vanity. So as we come to an end of the lesson, I'm going to give you a little bit of a preview. Because if you left now, you might think, well, I don't know if I want to come back, because this just sounds like it's going to be terrible. The key to understanding Ecclesiastes. And I'm not saying that everybody in here has always had everything wrong about the book. But I suspect that a lot of you have been like me for a long time. The key to understanding is understanding the perspective from which the statements are made. And here are the two perspectives that we're going to see in the book. And so our task is going to be, when we read, is this the perspective of A or B? So here's the perspective. Life under the sun. He says it there in verse 3. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? So here you have one who, this is all he sees. This is the only existence that he's aware of. The only existence that he is mindful of. This is the ungodly man. And when we say ungodly, I think Tad mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, we don't just mean somebody who's immoral and wicked and sinful. We're talking about somebody that just does not have God in mind. Somebody who's not mindful, constantly mindful of God. So that's one perspective. It's just right here, what we have around us, in front of us, life under the sun without God in view at all. And then, on the other side, the other perspective that we are going to see in the book is life above the sun. The one who is godly, the one who does think higher than just what we can see around us. And when we begin to view these passages and look and see, okay, whose perspective are we looking at? You know, who's talking here? Is this the carnal man? Is this the ungodly man, the man who only sees life under the sun? Or is this the godly man, the one with God and eternity in view? And when we begin to see that, then we'll see, well, yeah, that is true. What he just said is true according to that perspective. And so without reading it all again, if you look at verses 2 through 11, and you understand that that's written with the perspective of life under the sun, that this is it, well then, yeah, that's absolutely true. Well, what we're going to find is that's not the only perspective. We have a higher perspective. And if we can't see in the book of Ecclesiastes that higher perspective and begin to view things in the right way, we're not going to see God in the book. We'll have a very difficult time. But more importantly, if you're among the ungodly, if you are ungodly and you don't think about God, and all you think about is this world and what's in this world, not even talking about now just the book of Ecclesiastes, just in your life, if this is the view that you have and this is your focus, then not only are you not going to see God in the book of Ecclesiastes, it's not very likely that you're going to see God at all. For God will be seen by those who pursue holiness. God will be seen by those who do think about God, who are mindful of the heavenly things and who pursue those things. And so let us be among the godly. Let us be one who understands that this world is not it. And even while we're here laboring and toiling in this world, this isn't it. This isn't where our energy and our time and this isn't what I'm laboring for. And so this has just been maybe a long introduction. As we get on into the book, I think you'll begin to appreciate with me some great things that will be of great encouragement to you. But as we close tonight, I would like to just offer words of encouragement to those who might be among the ungodly, those who've not given their life to think about God. What Solomon says at the end there in chapter 12, fear God and keep His commandments, for this is man's all. That is the conclusion. That is the purpose of this life. And what he says at the very end, we will be brought into judgment for every work, whether good or evil. If you're here tonight and you're not ready to stand in judgment because your works are evil, then repent and turn to God before it is too late. If we can help you to do that, would you come and let us know how we might help you while together we stand in sin.